America, the front line in the fight to save democracy.
Your Secretary of State says everyone who's here, citizens and non-citizens, deserve due process. Do you agree, Mr. President?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know.
Well, the Fifth Amendment says
I don't know. It seems it might say that, but if you're talking about that, then we'd have to have 1 million or 2 million or 3 million trials.
Wrong answer, Don. As the president pleads the fifth about the fifth, due process joins democracy on the deathbed. This is America. I'm Rachel Bitticoffer.
And I'm Aaron Murphy. Even for a world conditioned for chaos and crazy in American politics, Donald Trump's sit-down with Meet the Press will go down in history for what he said and for what he didn't.
Welcome back, by the way, Aaron. I thought you were sneaking in a break from politics until I found out you were actually in D.C. last week.
Yeah, no breaks for those of us who care about saving democracy, Rachel. I did attend an event up at the National Cathedral, which is about as far away from the White House you can get while still being in Washington, and I could feel the cold wrath of Stephen Miller all the way up there.
Oh, dude, then I'm sorry to do this to you, buddy, because we're going to be talking about that creepy fucking guy for quite a few minutes in this show, because we all need to pay close attention to what the Lord of the Shadows is saying out loud on camera. We're also going to chat about the administration's targeting of powerful law firms, plans for Trump's Kim Jong-un-style birthday military parade.
Hint, you are paying for it.
And the bone I have to pick with the editorial board of the Gray Lady herself. But let's start with that Meet the Press interview from Sunday. By the way, it is worth noting that for as much as Trump singles out the mainstream media as his enemy of the people, he has no problem using it whenever he can.
Trump's interview with Kristen Welker on Meet the Press lasted a full hour, focusing on his first 100 days, and what stood out was Trump's repeated use of the three words, "I don't know." He said it multiple times in response to multiple questions, including some easy ones about Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the Venezuelan national whom Trump deported to an El Salvadoran prison with no due process. Trump says he has a mandate to get immigrants the hell out of here, evidence or reason be damned, even though the constitutional right to due process applies to every person on U.S. soil, citizens and non-citizens.
Yeah, which is why the military put 9/11 terror suspects in Cuba, dude, not America, right? Because you got to have due process. Fun fact, if you want to change it, you got to amend the Constitution with a 2/3 majority in both chambers and ratify it in 3/4 of the states.
Don't you need to uphold the Constitution of the United States as president?
I don't know. I have to respond by saying again, I have brilliant lawyers that work for me, and they are going to obviously follow what the Supreme Court said.
I don't know. Remember, the Supreme Court ordered Trump to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return to the U.S. for his day in court. Well, that facilitation hasn't happened yet, prompting an actual fucking constitutional crisis. So when Trump says he'll obviously follow the court orders, it'd be nice if the host of the most important Sunday news show in the country was capable of remembering things that happened more than 3 days ago, because she could have used that knowledge that he is currently in defiance with the court order to push back on Trump's dumb ass claim.
Yeah, no kidding. Trump's Meet the Press interview also covered the Trump tax, his willy-nilly tariff disaster, his purposeful tanking of the U.S. economy and the global stock market, and even his admission that prices are going to go up. But do you think Donald Trump is going to accept any blame?
When does it become the Trump economy?
It partially is right now. And I really mean this. I think the good parts are the Trump economy and the bad parts are the Biden economy, because he's done a terrible job. He did a terrible job on everything.
Look, Trump's going to blame Joe Biden on his own bad parts for the next 4 years. The question is, will the American people buy that load of horseshit? Not according to the most recent public opinion polling. Kristen Welker pushed Trump on the rising cost of goods like clothes, tires, and strollers, and reminded Trump that he promised to bring prices down on day one. His answer, though, won't sit well to anyone who owns a small business.
We've been waiting 40 years for somebody to do what Trump is doing. So why don't you mention the big car industry instead of mentioning somebody that's doing strollers?
Well, I'm just asking you about small businesses. Are there any discussions about giving any relief to small businesses?
They're not going to need it.
Okay.
They're going to make so much money.
Are these tariffs?
If you build your product here. Remember, There are no tariffs if you build your product here. It's very easy. It's very simple.
He's happy. He's sitting there touting all these, you know, bailouts he's willing to give his, you know, certain people. But he just flat out said, small business, let them eat cake.
We've linked to the full interview in the show notes. And more importantly, NBC News fact-checked the whole ordeal. We've shared that too. Spoiler alert, it is long.
And there's another piece of news we watched closely over the weekend. 60 Minutes. I mean, that's a new show I grew up watching on, I remember, Sunday nights. We would sit. My mother, we were slobs. So my mother would sit us down on like sheets to eat pizza. But no matter what happened, we watched 60 Minutes. It was like a part of my childhood. So it really hurts me that the longtime executive producer resigned last week, saying that he has concerns the newsroom no longer has full independence from its parent company. And the reason, guys, is because 60 Minutes settled this bullshit lawsuit for normal editing that they would do with any interview of any A-lister, which Trump is pretending was a political contribution. And, you know, and just like in Columbia, just like in these law firms, they are obeying in advance.
So maybe it was an act of defiance, but 60 Minutes aired a powerful segment over the weekend about the major law firms that have successfully challenged Trump in court over the past few years, about how Trump has, well, weaponized the justice system against them and singled out certain lawyers by name, and how most of them have capitulated.
It was nearly impossible to get anyone on camera for this story because of the fear now running through our system of justice. In recent weeks, President Trump has signed orders against several law firms, orders with the power to destroy them.
The orders threaten to bar attorneys from where they work, courthouses and federal agencies, and cancel the contracts of law firm clients. For example, an aerospace company could lose its federal contracts if it stayed with the firm. A senior partner at one firm told us the president's orders were, quote, diabolical, intended to bankrupt us. He said within hours, his major clients were threatening to drop his firm. It took only a matter of days before America's wealthiest and most powerful law firms buckled.
In a shock to the legal community, nine major firms went to the White House to make a deal. Some say they were pressured not by a written order, but by a message from the White House threatening an order.
It is trying to intimidate them. The way in which a mob boss intimidates people in the neighborhood that he is seeking to either exact protection money from or engage in other nefarious conduct.
That's the voice of Mark Elias, the only lawyer named by Trump willing to speak on the record to 60 Minutes. I know from personal experience that Mark Elias is the best in the business when it comes to politics and defending the Constitution and American democracy. He's got one hell of a spine. He also publishes a regular newsletter about his work. It's called Democracy Docket, and it's worth checking out.
It's crazy to me that these law firms thought the best thing to do here is obey in advance. I mean, we're talking about some ridiculous amount of money that Trump's extorted from these law firms with, you know, promises of weird, dubious types of representation, because if you're representing Trump's interest in court, right, you are representing things that are facially unconstitutional most of the time, right? But here's why it really pisses me off. He tried to steal the election in 2020. He created a coup plot that crossed all the swing states, every GOP, state GOP organization, and more in this coup plot. And then when that didn't work, he sent an armed insurrectionist mob to seize power on the Capitol. I mean, that is what Donald Trump did. And this idea that the law firms that were protecting our election integrity capitulates to him allows him to make the claim that, in fact, he was screwed out of his victory by corrupt courts, corrupt judges. You know what I mean? So it's so erosive and corrosive that it's unforgivable in my mind.
got a few new executive orders, and here to help is Deputy Chief of Staff and Lord of the Shadows, Stephen Miller.
Mr. President, it's an absolute pleasure to be...
I almost peed my pants when I saw this on Saturday Night Live. The Lord of the Shadows, a.k.a. Stephen Miller, Trump's top toady and his senior policy advisor.
Yes, she is a beautiful creature.
God, you're creepy. This is why we don't hang out outside of work.
Understood, sir. Next
is a part SNL hit the nail on that shiny head, didn't they? Unfortunately, we got to turn to the real Stephen Miller, Rachel, who, as you point out, is not that far off from Dr. Joseph Goebbels when it comes to the implementation of fascism.
Yeah, the wildest part is Stephen Miller is Jewish, right? And in case you're thinking, well, one can't be a Jewish fascist, yes, one can. In fact, Italy had many, many Jewish people who supported Mussolini's version of fascism. And that fascism did not focus on anti-Semitism, although anti-Semitism is a common trait through Europe during this time period, certainly like they didn't have it. But it wasn't part of his platform the way that the German fascism is incorporated right in, right? You know, ultimately, it took a long time and the war to get launched and then to become a military alliance before you started to see Mussolini get in line with what Hitler wanted and start cracking down on Italian Jews. Actually, Aaron, here's something people will be really shocked to find out. Some Jewish folks in Germany were also super into fascism. Even though it included a clear platform for Jewish persecution, people are weird about politics when they face what us political scientist nerds call cross pressures. So, for example, a cross pressure, say, is a black voter who is fiercely conservative and maybe against abortion, right? They have two things kind of pushing in different directions for their political identity. A gay person whose rights depend, right, on liberal policy and jurisprudence. But, you know, they're being lifetime Republicans. The log cabin Republicans have held on through it all and are still voting Republican, even though they have more to lose than most of us if we end up in a Christian nationalist autocracy. So people just don't rationalize the way we think they do. And by the way, I shit you not, it was called the Association of German National Jews. So anywho, let's get back to what the Lord of the Shadow said last Thursday.
Children will be taught to love America. Children will be taught to be patriots. Children will be taught civic values for schools that want federal taxpayer funding. So as we close the Department of Education and we provide funding to states, we are going to make sure that these funds are not being used to promote communist ideology. For any nation to be successful, it cannot teach its children to hate themselves and to hate their country. So these are a few of the areas in which President Trump has fought the cancerous, communist, woke culture that was destroying this country, where we were led to believe that men were women, that women were men, that racial discrimination was good, that merit was bad, and that safety and physical security mattered less than the feelings of liberal ideologues.
The Nazis' takeover of the public education system in Germany was calculated. It was a comprehensive effort to shape the minds of the German people. It began with the youngest citizens. Hitler and the Nazi Party recognized that long-term ideological dominance requires more than just political control. It requires control over thoughts, values, loyalties of future generations. So schools and the university systems became essential instruments in this ideological conquest. For the primary and secondary, like school level of education, you know, elementary, high school, the Nazis quickly purged out teachers who were Jewish, but also teachers who they saw as, quote unquote, politically unreliable or not seen as sufficiently loyal to the party. So somebody who did not over time apply to become a member of the Nazi Party would be suspect. They all were forced into joining an org called the National Socialist Teachers League. So you know, if you think about like Department of Ed or the Teachers Union, that's the role, right? And what that did was it indoctrinated the educators in Nazi ideology and monitored them to make sure that they were achieving political conformity in the classroom, right? So today we would have cameras in every classroom and I know that, you know, Glenn Youngkin had a teacher tip line for this when he first got elected to Virginia. The curriculum, by the way, is going to be rewritten to reflect Nazi values. It was biology in particular. The Nazi movement is very around racial science and genetic race science. That shit died out, right? Especially when DNA revealed that there's no DNA race gene, right?
Right.
But at that time period, this was like kind of like a new science, and it was popular in a lot of places, not just in Germany. But basically, it argued biology became a vehicle for racial pseudoscience. It promoted the idea of Aryan superiority and eugenics and, you know, glorified what they called the Germanic past, demonized anything that was oppositional, especially Jews, but also communists and social democrats. And they framed Hitler as Germany's savior. Physical education, by the way, was the main goal of the Nazi education system, right? So what did he want? He wanted them dumb and he wanted them strong, you know, to cultivate obedient, militarized youth. Even math problems were written to reflect Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, it sounds like god-awful lot like what Stephen Miller just said the Trump administration is planning to do.
Yeah, I mean, as the mother of a disabled child, I do feel like I need to lay out what that means, because it's going to really gross you out. Another part of the Nazi ideology focused on what the Nazis termed or called useless eaters, the parts of the German population who were not able, because of disability, mental illness, other things, work in a productive way for society. So, the Nazis would teach kids math by making them calculate how much a burden on the state it is to keep, quote unquote, useless eaters alive, right? They were trying to first set up the public support of and then defend something called the T4 euthanasia program. This is the one thing that they shut down because of public pushback. But by that time, they had already murdered about 200,000 people.
Ugh, horrifying. Well, it also sounds a lot like the GOP when they talk about makers versus takers. So the Nazis seized control of curriculum in the schools, but what happened from there?
Then the Nazis also created Hitler Youth and the League of German Girls. When, you know, those were state-sponsored extracurricular mandatory participation. Unless you were a Jew, you weren't allowed to participate as long as you were a clean Aryan. Indoctrination programs, by the way, the way that they got everybody into these programs is basically making all other civic organizations illegal. Okay. So like all the shit that people do in their spare time, bowling leagues and D&D shit and that and whatever, right? They eliminated those and streamlined everyone into these participation programs. It was really about fostering loyalty directly to the Führer, right? And the sense of duty to what Hitler always called help the Volk, right? You're not an individual. You're a member of this body called the Volk, and that's the most important thing, the people's community. Education under the Nazis was not about making people critical thinkers, right? It was about producing ideological foot soldiers.
Well, and they did that at the university level too, yeah?
Oh, yes. I mean, at that time, Germany was the cultural capital of Europe. It was also the debauchery capital of Europe. It was the first place that you could see people being gay, right? It's part of what radicalized Nazis. So they took this once world-renowned university system that had Albert Einstein in it, okay, who is a Jew, and you know, obviously Einstein fled, that they purged Jewish professors, everyone that was a dissenting intellectual, everyone that had history disciplines or writings that dealt with Marxism, communism, anything like that. They took apart certain disciplines. Sociology and psychology were deemed suspect because of they were Jewish in origin, right? Who's our famous psychologist? Sigmund Freud, right? So they're erasing that. I mean, the universities that were once producing Nobel laureates became echo chambers of Nazi ideology.
Well, Rachel, that's not the only freaky fascist thing that the administration has announced in recent days. The U.S. military is planning to hold an army parade on June 14th. That's the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army. It's also the 79th anniversary of Donald Trump's birth.
The plan, a grand military parade in Washington. ABC News is confirming the event could include more than 6,600 soldiers, at least 150 vehicles, 50 helicopters, and some army bands.
This military birthday parade, by the way, is estimated to cost us taxpayers $45 million. Trump says that's, quote, peanuts compared to the value, whatever that is.
The value is, you know, we're going to look like Kim Jong-un, right? Or Putin. Here's the thing. When you're the strongest military in the world, and Eisenhower knew this coming out of World War II, we built by far the world's biggest military as a deterrence tool, right? It's giant for a reason. You don't need a fucking parade when you're the biggest, best military in the world. It is nauseating to think that we're going to have to watch that.
The New York Times marked the 100th day of Trump's presidency the way the New York Times does, with a nearly 3,000-word editorial.
3,000 words, dude. I mean, that shit might as well be War and Peace in the world of political tweets and sound bites. But yes, listeners, for you, we've read the whole thing.
It's called There Is a Way Forward, How to Defeat Trump's Power Grab. Here's an AI recording from the Times of the opening lines.
The first 100 days of President Trump's second term have done more damage to American democracy than anything else since the demise of Reconstruction.
The patriotic response to today's threat is to oppose Trump, the editorial says, but it is to do so soberly and strategically, not reflexively or performatively. Yes, the whole thing is worth a read, and yes, we've linked to it in the show notes, but Rachel, you flagged a particular passage in this editorial that got stuck in your craw. Let's take a listen.
Given the threat that Mr. Trump presents, we understand the urge to speak out in maximalist ways about almost everything he does. It can feel emotionally satisfying and simply like the right thing to do during dark times. But the stakes are too high to prioritize emotion over effectiveness. The best way to support American democracy is to build the largest possible coalition to defend it. It is to call out all Mr. Trump's constitutional violations while diligently avoiding exaggeration about what qualifies as a violation. Liberals who conflate conservative policies with unconstitutional policies risk sending conservatives back into Mr. Trump's camp.
Yeah, appeasement's going to get us all killed. It's so disconcerting because, you know, for the entire 4 years, I mean, Trump doesn't talk about running for re-election for the first bit. He's focused on the fake election stealing stuff for quite a bit. But he starts teasing that he's going to run for office again. And what does the New York Times do? And they're not alone. I mean, every major outlet, you know, television news, print media, PR even, just treated it like it's like something normal that to be an insurrectionist that just had a coup and is facing 96 indictments and just be like, I'm going to run for president. And then as soon as he did, like they give him this handicap, right? This handicap that has effect of normalizing. In fact, Aaron, you're going to love this. I was watching my local news just today and it was reporting on the Meet the Press interview, and it was talking about the due process section that we highlighted, and you know the reporters explaining the story, and then at the end of it, he did the thing that would have driven you batshit. He says the administration claims that the problem is activist judges who think that they have more power than the president. I mean, just reported it like it's a thing that we have, you know?
Right.
And it's just so, I mean, God, it. So anyway, yeah. The New York Times is, you know, like many, many people, I've been pretty pissed off about them. But, you know, the best part of the New York Times editorial were the comments. I mean, here's just a small sample of them. Aaron, hit it.
Jerry Engelbach writes, this is more than presidential overreach. Do we praise Mussolini and Hitler for rebuilding their country's economies, or do we look at the big picture and judge them accordingly? There is no evading the word. Trump is a fascist. His behavior fits perfectly that definition. Allowing him space for some things that may have hit the mark is a mistake. He still did those things as an autocrat. It may be that the only thing that will rein him in is to make his enablers in Congress fear for their re-elections in the face of his rising unpopularity. But in the meantime, what can we do as he blatantly defies the law and orders of every court, including the Supremes?
I'm with you, Jerry.
And here's Leon from Atlanta. Nice editorial, but missing the word fascism. Trump is following the path of Hitler, Putin, Orban, and others who do not believe in democracy and want to rule by decree. Congress is just a quaint feature of our government that Trump treats with disdain. Tariffs are destroying our economy, but Congress is unable to assert its role by canceling any emergency created in Trump's head. My mother's family escaped Germany after Kristallnacht by sheer luck, and I heard all the stories of how living under a fascist regime operated. It is all unfolding before our eyes. The courts have been neutered by the person SCOTUS anointed as a king. The Alien Act has been used to violate due process despite no declaration of war. And now troops are given policing powers along our border. My grandfather was summarily arrested and sent to Dachau by Hitler's regime, but fortunately got a U.S. visa and self-deported with his entire family. No different than what our regime is doing with deportations to El Salvador and forced self-deportations. We need a lot more resistance from the New York Times editorials for this country to restore democracy.
Man, Leon fucking gets it, which is probably why his comment's the number one on the page and has 1,600. Oh, sorry. So look, over the weekend, we made use of this new tech called AI, which you may have heard of, right? And anyway, despite the fact that it's going to all end in the Terminator someday, right now, ChatGPT is just an incredible tool, okay? You can ask it anything, and it will search the entire internet, and it will give you the correct answer. So I asked it if America was facing a greater threat from communism, you know, which is a word, by the way, that MAGA used to describe everything. I mean, they used it for Joe fucking Biden, for God's sake. Or from fascism, a word that does not appear one time in a 3,000-word appeasement article from the New York Times talking about Trump being a fascist anyway.
So here was our prompt. Is America facing a greater threat from communism or fascism? And this is what ChatGPT had to say. So I'm quoting here. Right now, fascism poses a far greater threat to America than communism. Here's why. Point one, fascism has a foothold. Authoritarian rhetoric, glorification of political violence, voter suppression, attacks on democratic institutions are increasingly visible on the American right, particularly around Donald Trump and his movement. These are textbook fascist behaviors rooted in nationalism, scapegoating, and the pursuit of unchecked power. Point two, communism has no traction. There is no serious communist movement within institutional power or public support in the U.S. The label communist is often used as a scare tactic, but no major political party is pushing to abolish capitalism, seize private property, or install a planned economy. Point three, historical patterns. Fascism tends to arise during periods of economic anxiety, declining trust in democracy, and rising political polarization, all of which are present today. It is not coming from some foreign invader. It's emerging from within. End quote.
I mean,
yeah.
It's a profound statement for a fake brain to come up with, isn't it, man? As I always say, Aaron, the data don't lie. I mean, it's frustrating to me that, you know, we wrote a book, right? We said, say the F word. What's the F word? Well, for once it wasn't fuck, it was fascism, right? It's so frustrating because if you spent any time engaging in like the political verse, social media, you know, media stuff, you'll notice that MAGA people use communism more often than they wipe their asses with toilet paper. But in my point is, like, it's coming not just from, you know, cat turd too sitting in his litter box, right? It comes from, you know, their political leadership, the Ted Cruz's of the party, the Mike Johnson's of the party, and of course, the Donald Trump's of the party. Yet, you want to know how many communists exist in America right now, Aaron?
Yeah, not many, but you probably have a better answer.
I do. It's 9,000.
Oh, yeah. Nothing in a country of 350 million people.
I'm trying to think, like, what else could we have just 9,000 of in the country? I mean, apparently Republicans with courage, we guess, you know, come to mind. But as I always say, the data don't lie. Okay, Our time's coming to a close. I need to continue speaking out in maximalist ways, and I hope you'll join me. Keep up with the grind on Twitter and Blue Sky, where you'll find me at Rachel Bitticoffer. On Substack, I'm at thecycle.substack.com.
And our book is Hit 'em Where It Hurts, How to Save Democracy by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game, hit'emwhereithurts.com. Look, we are not in the business of celebrating the Republican Party or anything it stands for these days, but we do like to end things on a hopeful note around here.
This year's John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award went to former Vice President Mike Pence for defying Trump. I mean, standing up under what must have been incredible pressure and just refusing to do shit he knows was unconstitutional.
Winston Churchill once said, when great forces are on the move in the world, we learn that we are spirits, not animals. Something going on in time and space and beyond time and space, it's whether we like it or not, spells duty. Our institutions held that day not because of any one person, but because leaders in both political parties, Republicans and Democrats, did their duty.
Funny how doing the normal constitutionally mandated thing is now a profile in courage, but and yet in another sign that democracy on its deathbed, that's what we've come to.
Look, I could listen to Winston Churchill quotes all day. In fact, it's the pathway to my heart if anyone's interested. Well, we're not going to just end the show on that because although it feels good, we want to make sure we leave you laughing. So we're going to go back to Saturday night for the most accurate description of Trump 2.0 so far. It's comedy so good it should be illegal and probably will be. Back next week.
President Trump's first 100 days have been the most dynamic since FDR. In that short time, President Roosevelt created vital government departments, forged new alliances, and established our nation's social safety net. And in just 100 days, President Trump did the same thing, only in reverse.
Me, your favorite president, and perhaps your next pope.